You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend. Tracy, it's Saturday. For me, it's a Pathfinder day, and it's also supposed to be 90 degrees today. So I'm rocking the windows open right now because it's already 70. And so I am living life dangerously as far as recording a podcast, because who knows what kind of weird noises are going
to
come through.
You're putting a lot of trust in your street, I have to say.
And Ronan, who's in the backyard, who might start barking at any moment.
Could have an extra guest with Ronan.
So. The dog. Yeah.
I mean, it's fair. My cats have been forcing themselves on the pod quite a bit over the last couple of months. So,
They have,
It's been a whole thing.
It's been fun.
So I guess raises a question worth asking. Our actual guest this week, Dao Wong, do you have any four-legged guests that might be joining us randomly at some point?
Nope, I do not. I travel a little too much to have animals, pets.
That's fair. That's fair. We're doing the juggling thing in my household of figuring out how to take care of the pet sitting because we're heading someplace in April for just like an overnight. And it's still a whole deal. Be better off just planning novels. Hey, talking about planning novels, congratulations on the release from Penguin Random House of the first book in your Thousand Li series, The First Step.
Thank you very much. Really excited to see it out in the world, actually.
So this is kind of an interesting journey for you, because it's actually the First Step's second book birthday, as it were. Yeah. So can you talk to us a little bit about the journey that got you here?
Okay. Wow. It depends on how far we want to go back. But let's just stick to the series.
100 billion years.
Okay, well, so there's just cells, right?
Yeah. Tiny little cells that we began with, and then they got really frisky with one another. Mm-hmm. But for The Thousand Li, I actually released the first book in 2019. And that was actually set up to be recorded by Travis Baldry of Legends and Lattes fame, but back then he was just Travis Baldry, the amazing narrator. For me, I was a self-published author. I still am, really. I still consider myself mostly a independent author. The releasing it into the wilds, as you will, was just a matter of course for me. Got an ebook, audiobook, did print hardcovers in it, started promoting it through to all the RPG and progression fantasy fans who were the ones who were mostly reading in this kind of subgenre of the world, cultivation, which is, for those who don't know, about the journey from being a mortal into becoming an immortal being. And so The First Step and the entire A Thousand Li series as a whole is about Wu Ying's journey from being a farmer to becoming an immortal being.
Very cool.
So one of the reasons, you know, we have lots of different people and their publicists and so on reach out to us to talk about coming on. And one of the reasons that I was a big smash the reply yes button in wanting to talk to you about A Thousand Li is, there's a ton of reasons, right? We share a little bit of DNA in that before I became a teacher as my day job, I was actually a martial arts instructor in my previous pseudo day job.
And I have watched martial arts films. So.
That is true. He has seen people
do
things. Yeah, I mean, samesies.
Saturday afternoon, Black Belt Theater.
Nice. But also the other, like the actual day job piece of things, I teach at a boarding school for gifted students that are all teenagers. And one of the things that they frequently talk to me about is like, what do they read when they get to choose what they're going to read? Patrick is making a note right now to put in the little X-Men 97 theme.
Yes, I am.
Right there, because he's such a troll. So anyway, I'm probably talking under it right now. So the... when my students talk to me about what they love in speculative fiction, more and more and more of them over the last 10 years have started talking to me about progression series and cultivation series. And it was really an interesting journey because a lot of my students are themselves either immigrants or children of immigrants. And so at first, it was just the students who were like, from Taiwan or from Malaysia or from Korea who were talking to me about these things. And then it started turning into like all of them. And I find it really fascinating and kind of exciting that this very particular subset of people who are like 16 to 18 are just so carried away by and charmed by this whole idea of series that are about growing yourself from being kind of nobody into mm-hmm. being one of the biggest imaginable somebodies. So I guess the question that for me comes out of that is, what brought you to progression fantasies?
The Japanese. So a lot of lit RPG writers specifically, they actually find their way through the Russian lit RPG works that came out in 2012 or so, that started really coming out, and that's when they coined the term lit RPG. For myself, I actually came through the Japanese light novel series, light novel universe. I was watching things like Konosuba, Grimgar, of Fire and Ash, and Danmachi at that time. You know, really interesting anime, and then I started reading their light novels going, that's only one season. Come on, there's got to be something else.
Yeah.
And from there, I ended up on Royal Road, where a lot of the new, you know, the first wave, what I considered the first wave of Western lit RPG authors were writing. And so people like James Hunter was there, Puddles, who wrote Legend of Randedly Ghost Hound. Who else was there? Luke Chilomenko, Scotty Furch, you know, a whole bunch of names that if you're in the lit RPG genre, you kind of know as the first gen people who were writing there. And I looked at them and went, oh, this is really fun reading their things. And because Royal Road is a free fiction website where writers can just write on it and post their work up, I started doing that too, because I'd done writing, you know, on and off, for myself, you know, with some viewpoint that I would become a writer one day in the far future when I retired, kind of thing. But I thought, you know what, I'll have some fun, start writing. And then I kept writing, and then I turned around and went, oh, I have a book. I guess I should publish this or something. So that was basically my journey into lit RPG. And from there, I also started reading cultivation web novels, specifically via web novels and Wuxia World and places like that. And I really enjoyed certain aspects of the cultivation works that they were doing, especially the ones that I was reading, which were a little bit more power progression fantasy forward rather than the Danmei ones, like Untamed, right, where it's there's the romance side of it, and the chemistry between the protagonists is more important than the power progression, which is perfectly fair. And I enjoy reading those too once in a while. But I went through the power progression side very much more. And that's how A Thousand Lee actually came about, because I was seeing a lot of things that I liked, but I was also missing a number of things that traditional wuxia brought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have to imagine that for the students that I'm thinking of, who have kind of are the ones who educated me about the existence of these genres and like how they function and some of the authors that you've name dropped and things, I have to imagine that there is sort of a common thread of qualities that this type of storytelling has that particularly draws in these teenaged readers. And to be clear, like progression series are not explicitly written necessarily for any one age group or another. They are written sort of like age agnostically, I think might be a good way to describe it. But they happen to be very popular with the teenagers who I know. And that in and of itself is really fascinating to me. And it kind of makes me wonder, like, what are the qualities of a progression series you think that particularly key into what teenagers experience or need or feel like?
I think there's a few aspects of it. One of it is a lot of the heroes are generally, they're outsiders in at the start of the show, right? At the start of the book. They often are not as potentially socially integrated in there. Or if they are, it's with a group who are, you know, nerds as well. You know, D&D groups are a common subtrope that, you know, they all become part of this growth. So I think there's the outsider perspective that you get. There's a lot of works that are found family tropes as well. You know, people that who can accept you for what you are. But also, I think, especially specifically for progression fantasy, it's the control that you have over your life. With progression fantasy, it is a very clear journey upwards, right? If you do X, you get Y, right? If you do 100 push-ups, you will gain one point in strength. You know, if you do, sprints for hours, you will increase your endurance. Life itself, even, you know, and we take physicality and martial arts and mathematics, yes, you can progress, but it's, if you've done any, and you've mentioned you've done martial arts, you know that that's often plateaus, there's, you know, times when you get even worse than normal, right? So that progression, even in our own lives, is not one-to-one very much, whereas progression fantasy is very much one-to-one, you know, ratio of effort to reward. And that's, that helps a lot. It's simplistic in some ways, but when you're, you know, in a world that's so much chaos, sometimes having a little bit of simplicity is nice.
Yeah. So one of the things that Patrick and I were talking about before you actually joined us was, I was musing about being interested in how markedly more popular this type of storytelling has become to Western audiences over the last, you know, decade plus. And, you know, Patrick is always quick to notice these sorts of links, but he jumped right on the kind of ascendancy of tabletop RPGs in, you know, they've been present in Western culture for, you know, 50 years now at this point, but the idea of them being more mainstreamed is much newer.
COVID caused it, because a lot of people were gaming during COVID, and that's when Critical Role became like huge, and Dimension 20 and Glass Cannon and all those kinds of people. And
we see actually a lot of players definitely coming from tabletop and areas like that. We are also seeing a lot of on the opposite end, old gamers who just don't have time to play video games anymore, you know, and they still want that feel of being in a video game or in that kind of universe and that expansive, you know, world building that you get in some amazing worlds out there. But they don't have 60 hours to sit down and play through, you know, Witcher 3 or Baldur's Gate 3 or, you know, all of, you know, or replay Mass Effect. So I think we see that, we have multiple generations who have grown up with video games as, you know, a touch point for their lives, right? So the stats and all of that is now something that is just embedded in conversations to some extent.
Well, see, and I think the problem is you start a game like Baldur's Gate 3, and then something happens and you're interrupted and you can't play it for a little while. And when you come back to it 4 years later, you've forgotten everything.
That's so true. I still haven't finished Dragon Age because of that.
I have the one game that I have actually played the most of was Horizon Zero Dawn.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to the end and I refused to finish it.
Oh?
Yeah, it's still sitting there. I have not finished it. And it's funny because my friend Giles, you know, I was talking about it so much, he decided to play it. And he is that guy. He will replay games over and over and over and over and over again. I can't tell you how many times he's redone all the Fallout games, as an example. But he played while I was sitting there going, I'm just hunting right now. Like I refused to do the last battle. I just kept going out and hunting and doing other things and not, and he like finished the whole game. He's like, yeah, that was really cool. I go, oh, you finished it? He's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, okay, well, fine, be that way. You know, like I'm not finishing it. It's still
spoil the fun.
Yeah, now they've come out with a sequel. I haven't started that, but yeah.
Yeah, it's terrible as well if you're a completionist and you want to go and play these games because there's so much content in some of them. And you're just like, I have a real life, people.
And see, that's what two of my friends do, Giles and Jeremy. They like to get all the achievements and all the little things that you get from PlayStation. Neither one of them do Xbox. So they just like to get all the ones from PlayStation, like all the the achievement that you can unlock and stuff with the game. They go for that. They like that stuff. I never remember that stuff exists until I get one. Then I'm like, oh, cool. I got some random achievement that I didn't know was there.
Yeah.
I have to stop myself from thinking about those things. Otherwise, I will become obsessed with it.
Sure.
It just no.
So a number of years ago, one of my colleagues in the department where I teach tried out a gamified version of his syllabus and class policies, and it was very detailed. And so I'm just going to give like a too long didn't read version of it here. But he tied students' grades or the opportunity for like bonus, you know, credit and things to various things that he referred to as achievement badges. And he's very artistic and crafty as well. And so he had created like some physical actual tokens with like painting and 3D printing and whatnot that represented like these achievement badges. And so like the first time you come to his class during you come to his office during office hours to talk about revising a paper, you get the revision discussion achievement badge. And he was like so proud of himself. He would like hand this to the students and be like, here you go. And they would look at him and be like, blink, blink. And they were like, what is this? And he had a number of different other angles to it that made it kind of like, you know, if you get a certain number of badges, you can trade them in for something else. And like, it was just very much the kind of progression economy mindset of the video game world. And he was just so disappointed that the students were just baffled by it as opposed to seduced by it. And then later he tried to just have like, he's like, okay, guys, like we've been doing this for a quarter and I've been trying to do this for a quarter and like you're not really acting like you're feeling it. What's the deal? And they gave him this really interesting piece of feedback where they were like, we play games to play games. It feels weird for you to put that in our class. Can we just like have a class? And he was like, okay. And he came to lunch that day and he was just like so let down. He was like, I thought this was really gonna work.
Wait until those kids get to adulthood and then they get a job and then the job is gamifying things and you get bonus sleep points when you do something really, really good and you can turn those in to get yourself an iTunes card and blah, 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 blah.
Sure, sure. And I guess like I'm bringing this up partly because, you know, it's germane to the completionist mindset, which I think he was trying to tag into with his students here. But I think it also says something about like, we're happy to include some of the either overt or covert mechanics of a game in certain elements of our lives, but in other places we're like, no. And this is an area that you have a lot of experience in and understanding in, Thal, because A Thousand Li is not your first outing into something that has a little bit of a structure that resembles what we think of as game progression, because you've got the System Apocalypse lit RPG as well.
Yep.
In your background. And so I'm kind of interested in, if you were going to kind of define some of the crucial differences between like a System Apocalypse lit RPG reading experience and the Thousand Li, what would it be? Like you talked about like the Wuxia thing, for instance.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a big difference between the cultivation genre, subgenre, which A Thousand Li very firmly sits within, and the lit RPG genre. And one of the biggest differences is how hard the magic system is, really. Cultivation and lit RPG systems, they're all part of a magic system. It's just, and lit RPG systems, for the most part, are very hard systems, right? They are, with the system Apocalypse, there are stats for everything from strength to intelligence to wisdom, mana. You know, he has skills. The skills have a certain amount of mana that has to be used to go and trigger them. You know, how he gets those skills even come in a skill tree format. So if you play Baldur's Gate or something like that, not Baldur's Gate, Diablo, you have a skill tree that you go through and you have to unlock certain ones before you can get to the next step. So it's very codified. And System Apocalypse is probably one of the crunchier systems out there for the RPG. There are some softer systems out there. The Wandering Inn has a relatively soft system where you don't get EXP, for example. So you might get, but there are achievements that happen, but you just don't see it, right? As the book, for the most part, doesn't show you that. It's just you go to sleep and then you get level up sometimes, and you sometimes get new skills. But it's still a lit RPG system because you have those things, but it's softer. But it's still much harder than something like the Cultivation World and A Thousand Li, because A Thousand Li is... There are gradations in power, but those gradations in power are often based off achievements that you have made. So they're closer to belts in martial arts. Okay. So you could have a white belt who could beat a black belt if he's really, really lucky that day and does something. But most chances he's going to get his ass kicked by the white belt, whereas fighting upwards to a yellow or a green belt, that's much more viable kind of thing, depending on the white belt and whatnot. So the power system in A Thousand Li is much more flexible. Why you go up or how you grade yourself and is also more flexible. There are also big jumps between power systems, I think, and power levels. So someone who's going from body cultivation, body cleansing to energy storage can possibly fight upwards a little bit. Whereas from energy storage to core formation, which is the next level, that's a significant increase in strength, right? That is closer to, you know, the difference between someone with a flintlock pistol and a submachine gun, you know. Yes, theoretically, but really, that's a big, yeah, you know, technological difference between these two. So you've got, and I think that's the big difference. They're both progression fantasies. And of course, you know, the cultivation system, at least the one that I wrote, is a Xianxiao world. So ancient China, second world ancient China, culturally sets around somewhere around the Song Dynasty, but with warring states period, geography and kingdoms and areas like that. There are cultivation works that are just cultivation works that in a secondary world that, or even a Western world or urban fantasy. Sarah Lynn did a really interesting near future kind of urban fantasy cultivation lit RPG mix as well. Though her lit RPG elements were more tracking numbers of what the individual achieved.
Yeah. That's really, that's a lot of sort of moving parts that you've pulled together there in a really exciting and interesting sort of way. So this is a swerve in the conversation, mm-hmm. but I feel entitled to pick it up because you brought up belt ranks and things. So, in your background with martial arts, I'm curious about the martial art that you most enjoy practicing, most enjoy doing things from, versus the one where you most enjoy watching someone who's really good at it do the thing.
That's an interesting distinction.
Do you want me to buy you some time by talking my own for a sec?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, all right. So when it comes to actually practicing the work, I thrive most and enjoy most practicing Taekwondo because that was sort of my first martial art. And I like the way that I can balance striking with different parts of my body and sort of the positioning of body through forms and things, that there's a role to be played for kind of the performance and the system of it, but also the kind of combat elements of it. But when it comes to like actually watching people do stuff, I love watching capoeira. I love watching people who are using this particular style, which is such a fusion of this, like these different sort of slave dances and different sorts of artistries and things. There's also a lot of Escrima kind of like stick work and stuff that goes in there that I think is super cool. So yeah, sign me up to watch that stuff any day.
Nice. Yeah, I actually haven't watched a lot of capoeira other than, you know, the usual TikTok and YouTube clips, which I wish I had practiced that once when I was still less broken. I don't think I could really do it now, which is actually kind of is important to my answer. Before I was as old and broken as I am, I really enjoy kickboxing, practicing it, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't mind getting hit, and I was okay at it, right? I was never very good at anything, but I could hold my own, and it was fun. The adrenaline rush, you know, getting just figuring out the holes in someone's defenses and all of that was a ton of fun for me. Whereas these days, I think practicing, I'm studying judo now.
Oh, cool.
And that's a probably what I am enjoying the most, because I have never really learned throws as well. I did a few here and there. I mostly learned locks and, control techniques, not as much the actual throws, and learning full-on judo throws and just the subtleties of it is a lot of fun. Also a little easier on the body because, you know, even though if I'm getting thrown around, it's on soft mats and the opponent is doing his best not to hurt me.
I've done some Hapkido and Jiu-Jitsu before and they are not forgiving if you practice badly.
Yes.
Which mostly is what I do with Hapkido and Jiu-Jitsu. So.
Yeah.
So Patrick, I'm not letting you off the hook on this one. So we'll just, I want to put this into terms that are friendlier for you. What martial arts stuff, performer, film series, whatever, like, are you happiest to see?
I like the style that they developed for the John Wick films, the what they call gun fu. it's different, and it's also very fast, and they just do it so well. Like there's that whole I forget what the name of the company is, but I watched the documentary Wick is Pain, where they talked about it. And there's like a company, and it's like all of these stunt performers kind of created this company in order to try to do cool things.
Yeah.
Like they just wanted to come up with cool ways to do stunts and integrate martial arts and stuff. And that's where they developed what they ended up calling gun fu. Right. And then they taught that to Keanu Reeves, right? And the thing that they always liked about Keanu Reeves and that they talk about throughout that documentary, by the way, is that he never says no. Mm-hmm. And you talk about being old and broken. Like one of the things that they talk about a lot is the fact that his knees are fucked up.
Yeah.
And so he'll be doing something and all of a sudden they'll just notice that he's moving differently. And it's because like he popped his knee out, but he's still trying. And so it's like he's kind of this tall, gangly, awkward white guy, but he's still doing this stuff. Right. And so I do like that. But if you remember not too long ago, I rediscovered, and I didn't know that they were available on Prime, all of these old Hong Kong martial arts films from like the 70s.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I grew up on, is watching those. And so like I got back into those big time. I was watching every single one of those that I could that was available on Prime. Those are just different and fun. It's like a different time completely.
Oh yeah,
absolutely. I just enjoy those.
Those are this is not at all on that same level, and it's definitely it has aged problematically, I think is a way of saying it.
Sure.
But I do have a particular love of Kung Fu Hustle. Like, it is very much like Looney Tunes meets sort of classic Kung Fu film that has its layers and layers of absurd premises. But yeah, I think if you were to make one of those like lists of things that you need to like to understand me or need to understand to understand me, Kung Fu Hustle would actually be on it, with apologies for its like homophobic humor throughout and numbers of other things.
Okay, yeah, I was trying to remember what the problem with Kung Fu Hustle was, but yes, 1990s Hong Kong cinema, homophobic comments and just homophobia in general.
One of the masters in the apartment community that ends up being harassed by the axes is a tailor who is very ostentatiously coded. It's beyond coding. It's just. Like it becomes a punchline, his various behaviors. And it's kind of opportunistic in that way. Yeah. But damn, it's a good film. I really like that film. All right. So I guess since we're talking about things that we like, it's probably a good time for Picks of the Week.
We'll get to Picks of the Week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes. Like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere, but you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month. And that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever. Are brand new and popular so far. I'm enjoying it. A lot of other people are enjoying it. But our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us and we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on, what are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
All right. So Patrick, can you start us off with your pick?
I can. This will surprise no one. It's a documentary.
We have our lanes.
It's currently on Prime, and it crosses two of my favorite things, which is the Beatles and documentaries. And this is Paul McCartney, Man on the Run.
Oh.
And this is focused on that time in Paul McCartney's life when the Beatles are ending and he's trying to figure out what he's going to do. And it talks a little bit about how, you know, he rather unfairly took the blame for the Beatles. He's the first one to leave, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And really he argues that John left, but that it came out that Paul left first. And so there's this whole thing. Anyway, this just covers the years where he did a couple of solo albums that didn't do very well. But at the time, he started to build this band around him. And he discovered that Linda could sing. And he said, well, if I do a band, will you be in the band? And she said, yes. And they started finding, you know, different people, like a guitarist and a drummer and this and that. And they formed Wings, the very mm-hmm. first iteration of Wings. And it just covers that, the formation of Wings, those players leaving and the controversy involved with that. I don't know if you know about that, but they basically said, we weren't getting paid. We're living homeless people and we're not getting paid. To which Paul's response was, that's my fault. I wasn't paying attention to the money. I didn't realize people weren't getting paid. Okay, sure. But I also feel
if you're married to someone as a professional musician and you don't know that your spouse can sing, that's also a major not paying it. You never even ran into her, singing to
she
herself.
She was a photographer. She never really sang. She didn't.
Until even in the shower?
Apparently not.
Jesus Christ, you're married to this person. Pay attention
not.
To anything, Paul, but please continue.
But it was when he started doing his solo stuff that she would sing on some things and she would sing. And he's like, oh, you can sing. Let's do this together. And it goes on from there, and the different iterations of Wings, all the way into Wings Over America, and then eventually how Wings kind of fell apart. So it's just that time frame of leaving the Beatles, starting Wings. Wings ends. It's just that. There's tons of good music in there. There's great interviews. Mm-hmm. Do I think that it, because Paul is involved and he's the executive producer and everything on this, that it kind of shines over how badly he mistreated the first iteration of Wings? Yes, I do. Yeah. But those guys also came on and they talked as part of this. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they did say stuff. I've read other things where they were less kind about how they were treated in that first iteration of Wings.
So what you mean to say is he probably did better in representing himself credibly than Tyra Banks did with the America's Next Top Model documentary.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, he also he did face it and he did talk about these problems that he had. And he also talked about the problems that happened at the end of the Beatles.
Yeah.
So it's good stuff. Paul McCartney, Man on the Run, Prime Video.
That's cool. Do you know who else can sing, Patrick? Ronan.
Yeah, you hear him in the background.
He's in the background right now.
Yeah,
he's having a great time. We love it. That's how we know this is authentic homebrew podcasting right here.
And now he's run all the way around the house to the side, and he's barking out the front.
Well, I mean, it's like symmetry, right? You can't over bark one side. You've left the other flank undefended. This is clear.
And see, the thing is, Tao, I'm playing Pathfinder later on today, so I'll be leaving the house, and so I'm letting him stay outside and run around
get
in the sunshine
crazies
right
out.
Now and get it out before I have to lock him in the house.
Yeah. Anyway,
that's not unfair.
Yeah.
So, Tao, how about you? What is something that you would recommend?
I just got a friend, Kristen Cameron, who's an author as well and writes historical fiction, onto this TV series called The Longest Day in Chang'an. And it is it's not really historical fiction, but it is set in the Tang Dynasty. It is 48 episodes long because it's Chinese cinema. Yeah. And it is basically a murder mystery. It's a 24-hour, it's like 24, the TV show, but done in China in the Tang Dynasty period, with a guard captain who is scruffy and broken down and supposedly condemned to death for messing up, but now he's being brought out to go and deal with this conspiracy that might be affecting the emperor because it's there's a big New Year's Eve celebration that is going to happen, and it has to be solved right now. And part of the reason why I love it so much is that the creators actually spent time doing the research. So it is one of the most elaborate and well-researched work on the Tang Dynasty, Chang'an, which is was the old capital of China. And you see art and clothing and dress that is period, which you don't normally see, because Tang Dynasty clothing is actually very different from what you'd expect from the Qing and Ming Dynasty shirts that you see these days, the Tang suit, even though it has nothing to do with the Tang Dynasty. But they also bring in music, they bring in authentic things like the way that they tell time. Like there's four different ways that I remember seeing that they use, like the giant water clock that they have inside the bureaucracy to multiple types of incense burners, including an incense burner that actually drops a metal bearing onto the ground, onto the plate, so that it makes a noise at every half hour increment. And it's just, it's so well done, so well researched. They literally built a mini city to go and so that they could shoot the Chang'an properly.
That is really cool.
Yeah, it's it starts a little slow, like, but it builds up. Oh, and one of the things that I fell in love with was they have a, and you might actually really enjoy this, they have a hand crossbow in there. They all are armed with little hand crossbows, and you actually see them use them as a quick, you know, quick reload as they are in this big fight scene where the guy is running through and reloading his crossbow and getting it knocked out of his hands and everything. So it's kind of like Gun Fu, but with crossbows.
Crossbow Fu. Sure.
If I'm not mistaken, the hand crossbow does have a reload of zero.
Does it?
Zero actions to reload the hand crossbow, I believe.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I could be wrong. I'm curious about the ball bearing on the incense. How does that work? Because that's like the metal tack in the candle they used to do. But I'm trying to think, because I'm thinking of incense as a very thin piece that goes up.
No, so they have it on a horizontal metal piece, right? And then it burns horizontally, and there's a little, if I remember correctly, there's little pieces of string. So as it burns across, it burns the string, and then it drops the ball bearing straight down.
That is fucking cool.
But they also have
fucking cool.
They have so many ways of telling time. I actually had to research into it for a thousand li because there's this very popular saying in Chinese web novels. He was doing something in an incense worth of time. And I was sitting there going, I have never heard this term. What is an incense worth of time? Is there a specific time period? I had to spend a lot of time researching it. And the answer really quickly is there is none.
Wow.
You can build incense, and there were people who actually were paid from the royal courts and everything specifically because they built incense to burn in certain specific lengths of time. And it was so well manufactured that it was very exact. So you light this candle and it's this incense stick and it's 30 minutes, or this one is 1 hour. And you could mark it off at each section so that you know. You could even have those big circular ones that hang up in the air, and they kind of look like a giant mosquito coil that kind of hangs. Mm-hmm. And you light that up, and it just will show off, you know, at different gradations, how long it's been taking.
That's so wild to me, because if you think about the engineering process that would have to go into that, you're trying to engineer something that's going to burn at really specific time intervals. When you're living in a world that already has difficulty measuring time intervals with precision. So it's like turtles all the way down. You have to step back and say, well, what's the next best instrument that's available to me to measure the unit of time I'm attempting to capture with this other unit here? And so it's like this translation process that you have to commit to with layers of technology to try to verify what you're
And I have to throw it out. I looked it up. The hand crossbow in Pathfinder 2nd Edition is a one-action reload. The heavy crossbow is a two-action reload. However, composite longbows, short bows, regular longbows, and regular short bows are all zero reloads. So no action.
Yeah, that's not right. With the, at least not with the repeating crossbows that they used to have in the Tang Dynasty. You can literally watch them how fast they reloaded. And the repeating crossbows were actually a common military equipment back in the up until like 15th, 16th century, mostly used in sieges because you had supply problems otherwise.
Once again, we are victims of our Western focus.
I know there is a repeating crossbow that's been used in D&D and in Pathfinder. It's not in my stat block, so I have to look it up somewhere else.
Yeah.
Don't get too excited, Patrick's players. No repeating crossbow for you. All right. So I have to reach over here to grab my pick of the week. I'm probably going to get some rattling sounds here on the mic. So my pick of the week is the game Takenoko. So Takenoko is not a new game. Everybody here has their lanes. Well, Patrick, one of his many lanes is documentaries. One of mine is games. And Takenoko has been around since like 2011. But it's newer to my family. We just got a copy of it a couple of years ago as a gift for Deirdre. And the things about Takenoko that make it great are pretty easy to capture. So in addition to the fact that it's just like adorable, look at the art, she said on the audio only podcast. Look at the art. The theme of it itself is quite charming. So the idea behind Takenoko is it's loosely based in the historical fact of the Chinese emperor having provided to the emperor of Japan as a symbolic peace gift our first kind of panda diplomacy act. Here is a panda. Take it. And so the emperor of Japan's got this panda and is like, oh, it's adorable. Someday we will make memes. And taking this panda needs it cared for. And the players in this game represent the gardeners whose job it is to maintain the bamboo grove where the panda will be living. There are, of course, a couple of problems to work with here. One, pandas have a very finicky particular diet in terms of their preferred bamboo and ideal bamboo. And so you have a couple different types of bamboo you're trying to grow. And also the panda itself is kind of a son of a bitch because pandas, the next time you're not in like a moving vehicle or something listening to this podcast, you should probably just look up like YouTube or social media videos of panda keepers and zoos trying to do anything with pandas because they're adorable, but they're just deeply annoying. So they get in everything and they eat everything and they ruin everything. And so there are two really cool miniatures in this game. One is a very harried looking, almost Avatar the Last Airbender cabbage vendor looking guy who is the token for first player for the gardener. And then there's the panda token, which is adorkable. This is a little fat dude sitting there, a little melanin guy. And the panda roves around the board that you are creating. And you have these lovely stackable bits in three different colors of bamboo that you are trying to cultivate. And what's cool about them is that they do indeed stack. The way the components go together is just really fun and tactile. And so it's kind of a puzzle, it's kind of a resource management thing, it's kind of an area control thing, and it's kind of a, oh God, the panda's coming and I'm not done building this thing and he's going to destroy everything because he's the worst game. It plays very well with across ages. The box says 8 and up, but we started playing this with Deirdre when she was a little older and still found it quite charming. It's a good 2 to 4, plays well with 3 as well. And best of all, If you're the sort of person who has trouble dragging people who care about to the game table and getting them to lock in and focus, it only takes about 45 minutes and is a really easy teach. So if you are looking for a hilariously strategic panda-themed game, Takenoko is a good one to go for.
That is awesome.
All right.
I also looked up the repeating crossbow, and yes, it does.
We're not letting this go. Can I use the repeating crossbow to defend my bamboo grow against it? No, yes, that would make me a fur mad. Let's not do that.
I'm going to horribly mispronounce this. It's in the T-I-A-N-X-I-A. Tianxia? It's in that book, source book, and it's also in the Guns and Gears Remastered for Pathfinder 2nd Edition. This crossbow has an internal chamber, and it lets it reload very quickly. So,
fun times. All right. So,
I got to get
I mean, you need to get your details right. It's important. Yeah. So, we've covered a lot of ground here. We have, of course, the first of the Thousand Li books is out this month. Congratulations. And the good news is for people who are excited about that, that the other ones exist as well and are probably hot on the heels.
Yep. Book two is coming out, I believe, in June.
Oh,
and
wow.
The third book is coming out at the end of the year in November. So
if you are a reader and also impatient and want to know what will happen next, Dao Wang has you covered. So where can people find you and all your super cool stuff?
You can find me on my website, mylifemytao.com. And I also have socials on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky under Dao Wang Author.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for being with us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook. At functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY, .social. I know, I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching, if you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on, and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent, so you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening, and I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake. Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, "Hey, I really love what you do," I'm like, "I'm sorry. Do you know who I like? I think you have me confused with someone else."
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.